Hi, and welcome back to A Twist of Fate. In this week's episode, we are talking about Amelia Dyer. Amelia Dyer was born in Pyle Marsh, a small village east of Bristol, on January 1, 1837. She was the youngest of five kids her parents Samuel and Sarah Hobley had. Her childhood was a dark one. Her mother had caught typhus, and due to this, Sarah had slowly started to lose her control of her own mental state. Amelia wasn't a stranger to her mother's rage fits, and even had to take care of her before she passed away in 1848. A few researchers had observed the impact that this had had on her, while learning what it had taught her about the symptoms from the illness. Amelia had an older sister named Sarah Ann, who had died in 1841 when she was 6 years old. However, she also had a younger sister, her mother, named Sarah Ann, and she too had died when she was only a few months old in 1845. After her mother died, Amelia moved in with her aunt and uncle, William and Martha Hobley, in Bristol for a while, before she had gotten an apprenticeship with a corset maker. Her father later died in 1859, and her oldest brother inherited the family shoe business. 2 years later, 24-year-old Amelia moved into an apartment in Trinity Street, Bristol. This is where she would marry 59-year-old George Thomas. When they had gone to get married, they decided to lie about their ages. George said that he was 48 years old, and Amelia said that she was 30. After the couple got married, Amelia went and trained to be a nurse. Around this time, she had gotten in contact with Ellen Dane, a midwife who had told her about a supposedly easier way to live. Ellen had told her that she had been using her house to house unwed women that had gotten pregnant and would allow them a place to give birth before she would put the baby up for adoption or let the child die of neglect. Shortly after meeting Amelia, however, Ellen had to move to the United States to keep authorities off of her trail. During this time period, unwed mothers struggled to make money because of the 1834 Poor Law Amendment Act, which had allowed men with illegitimate children to not pay child support. In an age where being unwed and having a child was highly stigmatized, this ruling led to the practice of baby farming. People would act as adoption or foster agents and would either take regular payments or one full upfront fee from these mothers to, in a sense, get rid of their kids. Many buildings had been set up to house these soon-to-be mothers and would even take care of them up until they gave birth. After giving birth, the babies were left behind to be raised as nurse children. If the soon-to-be parents were more on the wealthy side, the fee could have been up to £80. It was another £50 if the father wanted to hide his identity. However, if a young mother needed help and she was poor, which was very common, she would only be charged around £5. These workers would starve the babies as a way to save money and to rush their death. The noisier babies were given sedatives. Godfrey's cordial, or known as mother's brand, a syrup that contained opium, was frequently used amongst others. Dr. Greenhow, who had been investigating the practice for the Privy Council, said, "Opium had killed far more infants through starvation than directly through overdose. The kids would die as a direct result of severe malnutrition. However, the coroner would state the cause of death as debility from birth, lack of breast milk, or even just a plain and simple starvation." The mothers that did want to check on their baby or decided to take them back often ran into trouble, or some mothers felt too scared or guilty to go to the police. However, when they would go to the police, even they would have a hard time finding any of these kids that were reported missing. This is what Ellen Dane had opened Amelia up to. She had then stopped working since she had given birth to her daughter, Ellen Thomas, and then her husband died in 1889 and she needed money. So Amelia turned to baby farming. Amelia was pretty eager to start getting money from doing this. Along with taking in expecting mothers, she would advertise to nurse and adopt a baby in exchange for a large one-off payment and sufficient kids' clothes. Amelia had come up with a story to tell clients and to put on advertisements. She would tell them that she had a husband, was very trustworthy, and that she would provide their child with a safe and loving home. Amelia married William Dyer, a brewery worker from Bristol, in 1872. After having two kids, Mary Ann, who also went by Polly, and William Samuel, she left her husband. While baby farming, she decided that she was no longer going to spend the money on letting the kids die from neglect or from starvation, and started killing them right after receiving the payment from the mother so that she would pocket most of that money. She had been caught in 1879 when a doctor had eventually gotten suspicious about the number of deaths she had been reporting. However, instead of getting any jail time at all for manslaughter, Amelia was given 6 months of hard labor. She later said that this destroyed her mental health, even though it had been pointed out how she got off way easier than she should have. After she had completed her sentence, she did try to return to nursing, however, failed at doing that. Amelia had spent some time in mental hospitals because of what she said was due to her mental illness and suicidal tendencies. These visits to the mental hospitals always happened around periods of time when it was convenient for her to disappear for a while. Since she had been a nurse in an asylum, she knew how to mimic the other patients to make sure no one would get suspicious. Amelia had started abusing drugs and alcohol when she started baby farming. In 1880, she was tasked with taking care of the baby of a governess. When the woman had come to visit her child, she was immediately suspicious and had checked the child for the birthmark on their hip. However, the birthmark wasn't there. When police started getting involved, Dyer had either had another breakdown or faked one. At some point, she had tried to kill herself by drinking 2 bottles of an opium tincture. However, because of her substance abuse, she had built up her tolerance and survived. Because of the attention she had started getting from police and families, she relocated multiple times using aliases along the way. Her last stay in a mental hospital had been in 1893, when she had stayed at the Somerset and Bath Lunatic Asylum near Wells. She claimed that this had been the worst of her stays in these hospitals and never went back to another again. She moved to Berkshire 2 years later and with an unknowing Jane Smith, who Dyer had recruited while working in a jail, along with Dyer's daughter, Marianne or Polly, and her son-in-law, Arthur Palmer. Dyer had told Jane that she should refer to her as Mother in front of clients as a way to keep up the loving mother-daughter charade. In January of 1896, 25-year-old Evelina Marmon, a waitress, had given birth to her illegitimate child while staying at a boarding house in Cheltenham. The woman had quickly tried to find people to adopt her child by placing an ad in the Bristol Times and Mirror newspaper. The ad read, "Wanted, respectable woman to take a young child." The mother did plan to go back for her child once she had a job and could properly afford to raise her. While looking through the paper, there was an ad next to her own. It read, "Married couple with no family would adopt a healthy child. Nice country home. Terms £10. Evelina responded to a Mrs. Harding and a few days later had gotten a letter back that had said, "I should be glad to have a dear baby girl, one I could bring up and call my own. We are plain, homely people in fairly good circumstances. I don't want a child for money's sake, but the company and home comfort. I and my husband are dearly fond of children. I have no child of my own. A child with me will have a good home and a mother's love." Marmon had tried to negotiate to pay a weekly fee, which would have been more affordable. However, Mrs. Harding insisted that she pay the full fee in advance. Since she was in a difficult spot at the time, she agreed to pay the £10, and Mrs. Harding showed up in Cheltenham a week later. Evelina was shocked by Dyer's old age and stocky build when the woman showed up at her doorstep. However, she noted how the woman was affectionate towards her daughter, and still handed her over to the woman with a box of clothes and £10. Evelina decided to go with Dyer and her daughter to the Cheltenham train station, and even to Gloucester. She went home a broken woman. She had received a letter from the woman telling her that everything was good. However, after sending her reply, she never heard back from her. Dyer told Evelina that she was going to the town reading. However, she had gone to where her daughter Marianne was staying at 76 Mayo Road, Willesden, London. This is where Dyer had killed the newborn, using white edging tape and wrapping it around the child's neck. They later kept some of the clothing that Evelina had given them. However, most went to a pawn shop. The next day, she had taken 13-month-old Harry Simmons and had killed him using the same tape and method she used to kill Evelina's daughter. After that, Dyer had placed the bodies in a carpet bag along with a brick to add a little weight. She then headed to Reading, where she found a secluded enough spot at Caversham Lock and had pushed the bag through the railing and into the River Thames. On March 30th, 1896, a package had been found in the Thames River by a sailor, which was unknown to Dyer. The package that she had pushed into the river had not been properly weighted down and had since floated to the surface. In the bag was the body of baby Helena Fry. Detective Constable Anderson, who worked for the small detective force that was available to the Reading Borough Police, had made a critical breakthrough. The detective not only found a label from the Temple Meads station in Bristol, he had done a microscopic analysis of the packaging and had found the name Mrs. Thomas and an address. This was enough to lead them to Dyer. However, they didn't have enough concrete evidence to directly connect her to the crime. The evidence they did get from the witnesses only caused the concern in everyone to grow, resulting in DC Anderson, along with Sergeant James, placing Amelia's home under surveillance. They decided to use a woman as a decoy so that they wouldn't raise awareness to them being on her case. The woman would pose as a potential client, hoping to see what services Dyer would offer. If the plan went right, they would be able to 100% connect her to these crimes, or they would at least have enough evidence for an arrest. Police raided the house on April 3rd. Even though there were no human remains, the odor of decomposing bodies had hit the detectives like a truck. The detectives found the edging tape, a telegram about her adoption arrangements, and the numerous letters from mothers asking about their children. It was added up in the earlier months of the investigation that around 20 children had been placed in her home. They also found out that the woman was going to move once again, this time to Somerset. It's been estimated that after over a couple of decades, Dyer had around 400 victims, making her one of the most prolific serial killers of all time. She was arrested the next day and was charged with murder along with her. Along with her was her son-in-law, Arthur, who had been placed under arrest and charged as an accomplice. In the same month, the Thames River had been searched and six more bodies had been found, including her last victims, Doris Marmon and Harry Simmons. 11 days after Evelina Marmon had left her daughter with Amelia, she was being called to identify her body. After looking further into what was going on in the house, there had been no evidence found of Arthur or Dyer's daughter Marianne being accomplices, and Arthur had been let go after Amelia had given a written statement. The statement said, "Sir, will you kindly grant me the favor of presenting this to the magistrates on Saturday the 18th? Instant I have made this statement out, for I may not have the opportunity then I must relieve my mind. I do know and feel my days are numbered on this earth, but I do feel it is an awful thing drawing innocent people into trouble. I do know I should answer before my Maker in heaven for the awful crimes I have committed, but as God Almighty is my judge in heaven and earth, neither my daughter, Mary Ann Palmer, nor her husband, Alfred Ernest Palmer, I do most solemnly declare neither of them had anything to do at all to do with it. They never knew I contemplated doing such a wicked thing until it was too late. I am speaking the truth and nothing but the truth as I hope to be forgiven. I and I alone must stand before my Maker in heaven to answer it all. Witness my hand." Amelia Dyer, April 16, 1896. Her trial began on May 22nd at the Old Bailey, where she pleaded guilty to the murder of Doris Marmon. Some of her family and friends testified that they were growing suspicious about what she had been doing and that they had come close to catching her in the act several times. They had testimony from a man that had seen and talked to Dyer when she was disposing of two bodies at Caversham Lock, and her daughter had also handed over graphic evidence that locked down a conviction. The defense could only argue insanity, bringing up that she had been committed to two asylums in Bristol. However, the prosecution successfully argued the fact that both stays were just ploys to avoid being caught. It took the jury exactly 4.5 minutes to find Dyer guilty. In the 3 weeks she spent in an isolated cell, she had filled 5 books writing her last true and only confession. A chaplain had visited Amelia the night before execution and asked if she had anything else she would like to confess. She offered him the book, saying, "Isn't this enough?" Suspiciously, Dyer had been subpoenaed to appear as a witness in Marianne's trial where she was being charged for murder. The thing was that the trial had been set for a week after Dyer was supposed to be executed. However, it had been ruled that once she was sentenced, Dyer was already legally dead, and that made her evidence inadmissible, leaving her to be executed the same day as scheduled. The next night, she had been informed that the charges against her daughter had been dropped. On Wednesday, June 10, 1896, Amelia Dyer was hanged by James Billington at Newgate Prison. When asked if she had any last words, Dyer said, "I have nothing left to say," just before being hanged at exactly 9 a.m. This has been A Twist of Fate. I'm your host, Riley Joe. If you have any questions or requests, feel free to message me. Have a great day.